Crosswires, navigating news with faith with Father Daniel Brandenburg, LC, and Chris McDonald. Crosswires, today's secular news stories viewed through a Catholic lens, from a layman's questions and a clergyman's reaction. Now, here's Chris and Father Daniel.
Father Daniel, nice to see you. I'm just back from a trip to Morocco.
Yeah, Chris, that must have been pretty exciting. What did you see when you were in Morocco?
Well, I don't want to bore you with all the details, but it is a Muslim country, but yeah, the Christians got there first.
Well, that's definitely the case, because Islam didn't come until 600 years after the death of Christ.
And it's also the burial site of St. John the Baptist.
That's right. Awesome.
This first topic we're going to talk about is because the 60th anniversary of Vatican II was this past December 8th.
Okay.
The feast day, obviously, of the Immaculate Conception. Vatican II was considered the most significant event in church history in the past 400 years. While it didn't change church doctrine, it radically changed church discipline. The Wall Street Journal asks in an opinion piece, what was the point of Vatican II? The opinion piece argues that in the six decades since, there's evidence that the reforms have led to forms of Catholic light that in turn became Catholic zero. So to summarize some of the main changes of Vatican II, the language went from Latin to the local vernacular. So in our case, English for the mass. The priest's position changed from back to the congregation to facing the congregation.
Mm-hmm.
The view of other Christians went from, for example, all the Protestant denominations went from viewing them as heretics to separated brethren.
Mm-hmm.
The role of the laity was significantly expanded, increased, and the council explicitly rejected the charge of collective Jewish guilt for the death of Jesus, and it condemned all forms of anti-Semitism.
Mm-hmm.
The first question I have on this 60th anniversary is, what was the church-dividing crisis that in the past necessitated an ecumenical council?
That's one of the distinguishing features of the Second Vatican Council, is that it wasn't a response to a crisis, an immediate crisis at least. Most other councils in the history of the church have been responding to a heresy, to some sort of division, the Protestant Reformation, different things of that sort. But in this case, in Vatican II, it was more of a sense of Pope John the 23rd, that there was some need for an aggiornamento, is the word that was used in Italian, which is bringing things up to date bring things up to speed. It's like we need to do a little renovation in the church. That was the initial impetus of that John the 23rd gave when he announced the opening of the
council. Could he not have handled that in an encyclical?
Maybe, but he felt that the Holy Spirit was leading the church into an ecumenical council. And I think that the best way to look at the Second Vatican Council is to read those who were actually part of it and understood what the gist was. Now, there's an advantage of years of looking back. We can see with greater perspective. But I love to read the insights from John Paul II, when he participated in the council. Pope Benedict XVI, he was an active participant, not just a passive participant or an adjunct. If you read the biography of his life, just simply called Benedict XVI, A Life, it is fascinating to see the outsized role that he played as a theological impetus with the cardinal of Germany at that time. And he was proposing things and had a real insight. And Pope Benedict actually wrote a monograph explaining what the purpose of the Second Vatican Council was, giving some great insight. George Weigel also has a phenomenal book that came out a couple of years ago.
George Weigel, by the way, was the author of this opinion piece.
Yes, and I've read a lot of his pieces. He's always very insightful, and he does challenge many of the things. He's not a simplistic, like everything was great or everything was bad with the Second Vatican Council. The real problem that I have at times is people will say, the spirit of Vatican II, and they'll make reference to something that is actually not related to the documents of Vatican II at all.
All right, but what about this notion that it may have begotten Catholic light or Catholic zero? Do you think Catholic
There's
light...
There's no doubt that there was confusion.
Do you think Catholic light or Catholic zero would have happened regardless of the council?
I think that it always has happened in certain places. And some of the spirit of Vatican II that took place did lend itself to that confusion. There's no doubt. I mean, I talk with my parents. My parents were in high school during the Second Vatican Council, and they always tell me the story of how, you know, the priests in, that were preaching at their parish started to talk about how, you know, the miracle of the multiplication of the loaves. Well, it wasn't really a multiplication of loaves. It was just the miracle that people started sharing their bread. That was the real miracle of generosity.
Really?
Yeah, literally. And my parents, as teenagers, they're like, that's kind of weird. That doesn't seem to make sense. But these were kind of things that were happening. And there was also kind of a general sense among a lot of the clergy at that time that somehow the Second Vatican Council was going to get rid of celibacy. And so there was even, you know, all kinds of aberrations that went on during that time and confusion.
Well, I think about how much a part. Okay, so prior to Vatican II, the directive was, and I think most Catholics don't, and I didn't know this until my mother-in-law told me this, but
yeah,
that you're supposed to observe some sort of sacrificial act of penance on every Friday. That you're not just
That's still the case.
It is.
You look at canon law, it's still there.
Right, exactly. But I think most people think of Lent as abstinence. So abstinence from meat is still supposed to be the default. And if
right.
you choose not to do that, it's supposed to be
some other sacrifice.
And I think people think it's only during Lent. And, you know, it was so much the fabric of our culture that McDonald's introduced the filet of fish in response.
Arby's has it too.
Right, but they chose to do that because they saw how much hamburger sales declined on Fridays.
On Fridays, yeah.
And so that's how much a part of the fabric of the culture things were. And now we don't even know that you're supposed to give up something on Friday.
Yeah, but that's a separate problem. That's a problem of catechesis. And that happens when there's confusion. I think what happened in our country here in the United States was that the Second Vatican Council, there was tremendous confusion. There was liturgical experimentation. There was poor formation in the seminaries. But you look at what happened in Poland, for example, under the leadership of John Paul II when he was there as Archbishop of Krakow, there was not the same type of confusion in the faith. There was good catechesis going on. There was active engagement and understanding what the documents of Vatican II were saying. And it actually led to a great vitality of the church. So I think this is what we have to look at. Is our catechesis up to par?
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com. Crossed
Wires. The Wall Street Journal asks, what happens when welfare becomes not a temporary handout but an ingrained expectation of American life?
Big problem. I see that all the time because I work with a nonprofit called Catholic World Mission, and we try to avoid toxic charity where you create dependencies. It's a real problem.
The story out of Minnesota, which I'm sure you're familiar with.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Where 86 individuals have been charged with defrauding Medicaid and the federal child nutrition program to the tune of $1 billion.
It's just mind-boggling. $1 billion.
Gosh. So it begs the question, should the federal government be providing any welfare at all?
Mm-hmm.
So beginning with the New Deal of FDR and then amped up in the Great Society laws of LBJ, the long-term implication of government dependency from the discouragement of work to the damage to family structure, it makes me wonder on the basis of the Catholic social doctrine of subsidiarity, whether the federal government should provide zero welfare entitlements and all and push it to the state. So currently these programs add up to more than $1.4 trillion annually of federal spending. So what if we cut all entitlements out of the federal government budget and then commensurately cut federal taxes and left it entirely up to the states, the individual states, to bring assistance at the local level?
I would go even further. I would say let's push it down even to the local level. Because problems are always local. You know, if you've got a family that's in need, that like their, the husband got sick, out of a job, can't pay for their apartment, that's a local problem. That needs to be taken care of by family members and by the local community. And before the welfare state existed, how did we handle all these problems? Is it all of a sudden now we have these problems, we didn't have them before? No, we had these problems before, but the way that we handled them before was very different. We handled them through the local community.
Right.
Through the local nonprofits and through the churches.
Typically your local church.
It was primarily the churches, and that's what gave a lot of vitality to the church life.
One problem that I see with going hyper-local, though, is that if you're only giving to your local and it's going to stay within your local on the redistribution of what you give, you're going to have areas that are, you know,
gonna like be, a natural disaster hits or something.
Well, or just that you're, you know, currently you might have a richer area of town that's giving to their parish that's servicing a poorer part mm-hmm. of town. If it sure. stays within your zip code, mm-hmm. then it just isolates and walls off.
Yeah. So like we have Buckhead, you know, yeah. the problems in Buckhead, yeah. Atlanta are yeah.
Oh, no. There's
different.
A family that has only one car. Please give so that we can get them a second car. Well,
I had a conversation with someone recently about that because it's like they wanted people to give to this cause. And I just was thinking, oh, my gosh, in the broader context of things, this is really pointless. So I think you've got a point there, but that can be carried out by, again, let's just see there's a function that needs to be taken of these differences between communities. You can bring that to a higher level.
Right, well, the county level, but even then you'd have rich counties and poor counties. That's why I think mm-hmm. the state level is probably inappropriate, but the federal level should not. I mean, look, this...
Sure.
Nobody's looking.
Except
nobody's,
for perhaps in the natural disasters.
Well, of course. But that's not an entitlement. That's a response to...
Sure.
Right? Not a fixed entitlement program.
Yeah, but I would look at it even on the state level. So let's keep it at the state level. At the state level, there should be some degree of function at the state level, but it could be like we have a certain amount of funds allocated and we send these out to local communities according to needs. And you set up a set of criteria for the needs. And I think or helping the organizations that are helping people directly, rather than directly giving. Because anytime a government's going to set up a program, there will tend to be more inefficiencies than
right. if and it further, were. And the further away you are from the
people really
groundwork,
need.
The more inefficiencies and fraud, like what happened
totally.
Here, is going to
yeah.
happen.
And that's the real thing that I see. Because when a church is helping individuals, there's a program I worked a little bit with the pastor at St. Brendan the Navigator Parish up and coming. And they have a program to help people who need help with their utility bills or paying their rent for a month. But there's certain parameters around that because there are people who come around and try to milk the system. And they try to get money out of parishioners or stand at the doors, things like that. And how to avoid that fraud and help people to live a more dignified life. These are things that happen on the local level.
Crossed Wires.
If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crosswires. According to the National Review, Seattle Public Schools has developed a K-5 gender lesson kit.
That sounds exciting.
Yes. For
what's in this wonderful kit that they've put together?
Let me tell you, Father Daniel, it's good stuff. It's
oh gosh, I think our cynicism coming out, it just says hearing that it's coming from Seattle is already putting my bristles up.
So it's to introduce students as young as kindergarten to ideas about the malleable nature of gender identity.
Mm-hmm.
The lesson features a picture book with a teddy bear named Thomas who decides he wants to be Tilly, a girl teddy bear.
Okay.
The video component of the lesson is narrated by a Seattle Public School health education specialist who uses the pronouns he, she, they. Thank you very much.
Mm.
The guidance says gender is not defined as biological sex, but rather a person's feelings about being a boy or a girl or another gender.
Mm-hmm.
Seattle does not allow parents to opt out of these lessons, even though they do allow parents to opt out of sex ed topics. So basically, Seattle has elevated gender fluidity to a non-negotiable universal truth. What would you do? What would you do? I know you don't have kids, nor are you going to have kids, but right. let's say you lived in Seattle and you can't afford to send your kids to private school. What do you?
Move.
I mean, seriously, what if your job is there? What if you, I mean, what, seriously? I mean,
gosh, yeah, it's tough. You move or you send your kids to a private school or you homeschool. But when you're facing that type of ideological indoctrination, that's really what it
boils down to.
Remember
our topic from a couple of weeks ago about the teachers union
yeah.
and how their mission is to elevate the profession. And this is what they're doing?
Yeah, it's an incredible waste of resources.
Kindergartners?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it makes sense if from an indoctrination standpoint, because you want to reach people when they're malleable and haven't yet formed critical resources to resist stupid ideas.
Why then let parents opt out of sex ed topics when you can't let them opt out of?
I don't know. That's bizarre.
It's because they are elevating it as a non-negotiable universal truth that that there are more than two genders.
It's crazy.
let's stay in Seattle.
Oh, gosh. You know, Seattle is really a beautiful city. I went there a number of years ago for a conference, and it's really pretty. But I also encountered more homeless people there on those streets than any other city I've been to in the
United
States.
Definitely a grunge element there.
Yeah, it's kind of sad.
So the upcoming World Cup soccer matches will be held across the U.S., including here in Atlanta.
Have some games here in Atlanta.
Right, some important games here in Atlanta.
All right.
So they're also going to be held in Seattle. Okay. So FIFA is the soccer governing body that controls only stadiums and official fan zones during World Cup, during the World Cup in host cities. So the city of Seattle, which is hosting a game on June 26, 2026, they have put together an advisory committee to have gay pride festivities around a match between Iran and Egypt.
Oh my gosh.
Homosexuality is illegal in Iran and punishable by death. In Egypt, homosexuality is prosecuted under, it's not punishable by death, but it's prosecuted frequently under anti-debauchery laws.
Sure.
This is kind of funny, isn't it?
I don't know. It's funny. It's kind of like bizarre. They're definitely trying to press the envelope there.
Right. But the two nations are objecting, and yet Seattle is going to tell them that they know better.
Gosh, it's this, the kind of this idea that somehow we are, we're better than you. We have this moral authority because we are, I don't know, on the right side of history. It's kind of, it's ludicrous when you start looking at it from a philosophical and historical perspective.
FIFA should take the World Cup away from their city and put it put those games somewhere else. If you're going to require these nations to bend to your worldview.
Yeah. Gosh, it's kind of crazy.
That's not what it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be about soccer.
Crossed Wires.
If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crosswires.
A Michigan State professor's study of 38 million obituaries in America over the past 30 years reveals some interesting insights into what really matters. You've probably heard the axiom that no one on their deathbed wishes they worked more.
Yeah, that's for sure.
His study kind of lines up with that.
The average. Now, where's the study I get from again?
It's a Michigan State professor's study in collaboration with some other universities. I think New Mexico or New Mexico State, but he was the one who led the study.
Yeah, because a fascinating book that I was actually in the middle of reading, it's called The Happiness Principle or something like that. And it's from a Harvard study, a longitudinal study for over, I think, a 40-50 year period looking at the same question.
Okay.
But go on.
Yeah, so the average person lives roughly 4,000 weeks. And when they die, their existence is kind of summed up in a 175-word obituary. So this study, which was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, that's the publication, shows that Americans are overwhelmingly remembered for tradition, particularly religious faith traditions, and for benevolence to others. So the faith and tradition values dominated obituaries more than any other lines of thought, appearing in 80% and 76% respectively. So faith and values. So words like faithful, church, Bible, praying appear far more frequently than terms related to job achievement or other bucket list items.
Right.
In a random sample of 382,000 obituaries of those 38 million, education appeared frequently, as did military service and phrases describing the deceased as being beloved. So men's obituaries contain more than 8 words more on average than women's. And not surprisingly, older people were written about at greater length than younger people.
Sure.
As you've already had some thought about this with this book that you're reading, give me some more insights here about this, what obituaries tell you about what people think's important.
Well, the study that I'm reading is not obituaries, but it's looking at what are the factors that lead to actual happiness in people's lives. And it's tied to very similar things. It's all about relationships. And when you think about it, religion and its fundamental expression is a relationship. It's a relationship with God. It's the most important relationship in our lives. And life is made better by the richness of close relationships. First with God, then with a spouse. You know, a lot of obituaries talk about, the surviving spouse or beloved husband or, husband or wife. And then the children, relationship with children. And I hear all the time from elderly people, the two main regrets, Chris. The first regret is that their children left the faith. That is a very deep pain and sorrow for a lot of parents. So it ties back to what you're talking about with the obituaries, the connection to faith, tradition, values. And the second thing that that elderly people tend to bemoan is that they didn't have more children. And it's an interesting contrast because I meet with young couples who are struggling with young kids and the just the craziness of life. And it is hard. It's difficult. But contrast that with older people who just wish they had had more children and then consequently more grandchildren. That's a great sadness I see all the time when, you know, families that, that you know, maybe there's only a couple of kids, no grandkids. There's a lot of, you know, missed opportunities.
Well, you mentioned that it's hard. Well, in life, you know, it's universally true as when you're facing two choices, the harder one is the correct one.
Not always, but many times you're absolutely right. And I've seen this expression, you know, choose your pain. You know, you can choose to, you know, sacrifice the desserts and be a little slimmer, or you can choose the pain of, you know, being, you know, overweight.
Crossed Wires.
If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crosswires.
According to a study done by a University of Cambridge evolutionary anthropologist, humans are less monogamous than mice, but rank higher than Scottish sheep.
Well, that's really consoling to know that
we got that going
sheep.
For us.
Yeah, all right, got it.
Sheep in Scotland, known for their hardiness and small size, were the least monogamous species in a new study of more than 30 different mammals, while the California deer mouse took top billing as most faithful.
Interesting.
The study assessed monogamy by comparing the number of full and half siblings in a population. In an exclusively monogamous group, you only see full siblings, while in promiscuous groups, you see full siblings rarer.
Sure.
So comparing this to humans is trickier, right, because of the existence of birth control. So whereas in the rest of the animal kingdom, who you have sex with results in the offspring, you know, and then you can study the offspring, and with humans, it's not so much the case with our use of birth control. But looking at sibling outcomes, humans rank 7th out of 30 on the list, coming in just below beavers. Overall, less than 10% of mammals are monogamous, since in the typical mammalian society, males fight each other for access to females, and they try to have offspring with as many as possible to maximize the spread of their genes. That's how they're built. Animals take one of two routes with their offspring. They either have a ton of offspring and invest a little time in each, or they have few and invest significant energy in caring for them.
Sure.
Humans are obviously more like the latter, having few but investing significant resources into caring for them. As such, securing childcare might be the primary driver, is what this study thinks, as the driver of monogamy, right? Because if you're investing a lot of time, therefore it's good for your relationship to be monogamous, for the for your spouse, in this case, to then care for the offspring. So humans are obviously more, let me go finish on here with what was the bottom of the scale. So bottlenose dolphins, orcas, black bears, they were near the bottom spots with 4% or lower rates of with full sibling rates. And the sheep ranked the lowest with 0.6%.
Wow.
Yep. What do you think the significance of this is? So in God's creation, he has obviously intended man to conduct themselves with monogamy. But that wasn't always the case, right? In the pedagogy of...
It's still not the case. Yeah.
But I mean, it was even acceptable in the Jewish tradition up until 1,000 years BC for you to have multiple wives, right? And then as we became a more civilized society... And eventually with the new covenant, we are sort of at the final answer of, yes, you're supposed to be monogamous. But it's interesting that in nature, it's not the case. So what do you think about, what does this say about God's creation in the way that he has set this up for? He meant for, you know, certain mammals to be monogamous and others not.
Well, I think we have to look at it in a different way. There's a fundamental difference between human beings and every other mammal or creature out there. We have an immortal soul. Whereas, you know, dolphins and turtles and other animals do not have an immortal soul. They have a soul, understood in the Aristotelian sense that there's an animating principle, which when that principle is gone, they die. So there are animal souls, but our soul is different because it's an immortal soul. We're made in the image and likeness of God. And that sets us apart from the other mammals. So we have many things in common with other animals, and it's fascinating to look at these
studies. All right, so let's then set aside zoology. All the other mammals, because I think that's the reason, that's the very good reason to set them aside.
Mm-hmm.
What about this notion that up until 1,000 years B.C., that monogamy wasn't necessarily the, not the Catholic Church, but the church at the time, the Jewish Church's teachings, if you will.
Mm-hmm. It depends. I don't think we should universalize that, because this, even in ancient societies, the general rule of thumb was that if you were wealthy, if you were powerful, then you had multiple wives, you had a multiple harem, a harem of multiple concubines. But for the poorer people, it was more of a case of monogamy. You look at the case of, for example, of Nathan the prophet, who calls David in and tells him the story of the man who had one little lamb.
Right.
And he uses that story to call out the adultery of David and says, you know, this is wrong. Because that was the typical thing for the close monogamous relationships. You look at the ancient Roman Empire. One of the strengths of the Roman Empire was the strength of the family system.
All right. David's act was wrong, though, because she was already married, right?
Correct.
Versus taking on a concubine of women who are not married.
Mm-hmm.
So how could they have in Jewish thought that that was, even that was okay?
That it was okay to have concubines?
Yeah.
Because you're taking,
you're saying it's, you know, it was different between rich and poor, but you take the monetary element out of it.
Mm-hmm.
The moral element survives regardless of how wealthy you are.
Yeah. Well, I don't pretend to be an expert in ancient harems. Yeah.
Well,
but one of the dynamics that was going on in the ancient world was warfare, constant warfare. And who dies in wars? Men. Then what do you have? You have a bunch of women who can't find a spouse. And they are in a very precarious situation. So then they're either in prostitution, or they're trying to make a life of their own, or they go into a harem where they may or may not have sexual relations with the rich guy.
So it may just have been reflective of a non-civilized world.
Yes, and of a protection of these women into a harem where they could receive better care. Again, it'd be an interesting study, but we leave that for another time.
If there's a topic you'd like Father Daniel to address, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crosswires. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back again next week with a different take on the news.
This has been Crosswires, navigating news with faith, with Father Daniel Brandenburg, LC, and Chris McDonald. Today's secular news stories viewed through a Catholic lens on AM 1160, The Quest.